Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast. Welcome to Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast 8. It's great to have you. What did you think of The World's Last Wonder Chapters 3 and 4? Things are starting to get exciting. The World's Last Wonder is Australia's first space opera. At the time, from about 1871 onwards, Australia was enjoying a surge in newspaper-published invention opera, featuring inventors with futuristic inventions and scientific explanations, with the invention being the MacGuffin that drives the narrative forward. These stories appeared as an answer to the great invention rush of the 1860s to the 1880s. From about 1892, recognizable modern science fiction began appearing around the world as inventors began to write them, complete with detailed scientific explanations, prophetic inventions, and futuristic situations and environments. The World's Last Wonder is a number of things. Australia's first modern science fiction, Australia's first space opera, and Australia's last invention opera. In this sense, it is a transitional story featuring many of the hallmarks we recognize in the 20th century as modern science fiction, yet still featuring throwbacks such as gas lamp lighting and space cars instead of spaceships. Chapters 5 and 6 feature a discussion about the actual 1899 book Cellular Cosmogony, detailed explanations of orbits, the effects of decreasing and increasing gravity, a flyby of the moon, and a discussion on the dangers of meteoric matter striking the space car. Enjoy.
The World's Last Wonder. Unattributed. Chapter 5. An Upset of Gravity. As soon as Apollo had finished with the reporters, I introduced him to Fred Riva, and was pleased to find that the inventor readily endorsed my invitation to the young fellow to accompany us. On this point, indeed, I should have been greatly surprised had the result been otherwise, for there is a powerful attraction and bond of union between men in their resentment against a common enemy. For my own part, this sentiment was very little concerned, as had merely an abstract social grievance against either Sir Mark or Fisher, but I foresaw that we should be the better off, physically and mentally, for a companion to share the labours and enliven the tedium of the journey, and I had formed a good opinion of the young man at first sight. It was not long before the pioneer was again mounting skyward, and we were scanning the majestic scenes, to me and Apollo no longer novel, but ever fraught with new wonder for young Riva. The vast panorama below, with its curious illusion of concavity, recalling to mind the singular cosmogony of Koresh. And later on, the visible rotation of the equator from west to east between us and the stars, with many more marvels that I have not mentioned. Koresh, I may say for the edification of the uninitiated, is Cyrus Teed, the messiah of an American new religion. He publishes a very well-got-up paper, The Flaming Sword, which is sent all over the world to propagate his gospel. This gospel is in part a peculiarly sane and lucid exposition of humanitarianism and rational communism, which causes The Flaming Sword to be largely quoted by reform papers, although even in this part, a fitful gleam of madness occasionally breaks through. But its cardinal point is that the Earth is a hollow globe, 8,000 miles in internal diameter, on the inside of which we live, and inside of which the sun, moon, stars, and in fact the whole celestial universe, are suspended. The outside, according to Koresh's revelation, being thickly plated with pure gold. Koresh has also acquired immortality, the main secret of which, physically, is perfect celibacy. But this does not prevent his being associated with a female partner who chooses to adopt the title of Victoria Gratia, apparently miscopied from British coins. To the explanation of his wild doctrine, Koresh and his associates devote an amount of positive genius that inevitably produces in the mind of the reader of their literature feelings of admiration mingled, unless he is one of the sect, with corresponding regret at the perversion of indubitably remarkable intellect. We now began to steer to catch our proper course for Mars. You will understand that had that planet been precisely overhead at the moment of starting, a straight aim would not have sufficed to send us right. Mars and the Earth travel at different speeds round the Sun. the Earth's movement of rotation about its axis, in which we participated, had also to be reckoned with, and also the inclination of the radius from the Earth's center to our starting point towards the plane of the Martian orbit, besides several other astronomical complications, had to be calculated and allowed for. Naturally, Apollo had taken the precaution of constructing a tabulated statement beforehand, which served as a ready reckoner. Otherwise, the process of calculation would have been far too slow for our requirements, as we started by daylight, whilst Mars was fronted by the dark side of the Earth. We could not, without loss of time, greatly increase our elevation before coming round into the shadow, so that we had ample leisure for a while to study the surface of the globe we were quitting, from which already detail had disappeared, leaving only broad splashes of light, shade, and colouring to denote the larger geographical features, or the clouds by which they were here and there obscured. At the proper time, in the darkness which had fallen around us, less like night than like a tremendous eclipse, we got fairly underway to our due hearings, and a little while afterwards, on the same principle whereby our ascent had made the Earth's movement of rotation about its axis plainly visible, its orbital revolution began to be apparent. The great globe glided on ahead of us in its passage round the sun, swerving its shadow from off the car, which thenceforward kept its course through realms of unbroken day, save as to its own limited night that it made for itself on the side remote from the sun. This eternal day was, however, very little like what passes under the name of day on Earth. There, the atmosphere produces a diffused glow. But as we had long ago risen above the atmospheric limit, we looked out in every direction upon coal-black heavens studded with sparkling stars, and the only difference to sight between the night which we had quitted and the day on which we had entered was that the sun was now visible as well as the stars on a background of intense blackness, and that the Earth, from being, as it was when last we viewed it from the realms of its own shadow, a mere disk of darkness cue off from the heavens by a faint atmospheric halo of refraction, took on gradually the crescent appearance of the new moon, albeit far bigger to the eye and of a dazzling brilliancy. Within the car, the temperature was tropical for the time being, in spite of all that we could do to regulate it. Nevertheless, a small patch of hoar frost decorated the ceiling in the vicinity of each of the upper observation tubes. We were now approaching what was, according to advance calculation, the most critical part of the journey. The moon happened to be somewhat dangerously near our path at the time, allowing for the time lost in getting onto our course and in gradually working up speed. We were to pass her orbit on the fourth day out from New York, the time being somewhat shortened by the accelerating influence of her attraction. As a very trifling deviation from our computed direction of speed would carry us nearer than was prudent, unless we had intended to make a call, we suffered no little anxiety. It was not impossible that the annexator should have been timed to halt for a brief lunar exploration, and in that case it would be our part too to slacken pace and touch, whilst if on the contrary, then we should require to pass by at full speed. Her start would enable her movements to be graduated over this section with more facility than those of the Pioneer, and therefore it was not improbable that if we could but sight her, we should be able to judge from her going which course was intended. On this particular, fortune favoured us. For a few hours before the passage of the orbit, my attention was attracted to a small point of light traversing the unilluminated portion of the moon's disk. It was the annexator beyond a doubt, a little out of her right course, crossing very much nearer to the plane of the moon's orbit, as well as nearer to the moon's position along it than we should shortly be doing, and putting on all possible speed to avoid a collision. We watched her breathlessly, and I was really glad that Riva was not sufficiently posted in technical detail to perceive the danger, against which we were utterly helpless to assist. However, the annexator cleared safely, and by some remarkably adroit trick of steering, righted her course. Her success considerably relieved our anxiety on our own account, but nevertheless, we were destined to find the crossing a most disagreeable and trying experience. The moon loomed up, larger and larger, a vast mass part glaring with light, part invisible in shadow. We had gradually lost the steadying power of the Earth's gravitation until we could almost move about in the car like flies on the walls of a room, and had to creep with the utmost circumspection for fear of bouncing like acrobats. Still, the bottom of the car had remained practically the bottom, towards which all objects tended. Suddenly, I began to be conscious that a growing curious sensation was resolving itself into a fall sideways towards the wall of the car, as when one is standing up in an express train that shoots round a sharp curve. As I staggered under the influence of the force, which appeared to take me irresistibly its prisoner, a tin pannikin, which rested on a small bench surrounding the radio motor pillar, came flying across and smote the wall at my elbow with a resounding bang. A looking glass crossed the apartment as if by malice prepense to violently assault Apollo on the nose, and Fred Riva, with a comical aspect of alarm, was striking out horizontally from the middle of the wall like a gigantic hat peg, with his head doubled up against his chest and his legs wildly waving in midair towards the pillar. It will be seen that as we had now developed a high speed and the moon was also rushing towards our path at a tangent, the effect of her gravitation, increasing as the square of the distance diminished under the combined influence of the two intersecting motions, came upon us very suddenly and produced these disturbances, which were, to say the least, disquieting, even though we promptly recognized what occasioned them. They endured, paralyzing us with the most absurd sensation of topsy-turvydom, until we had crossed the orbit to a somewhat less distance than that at which they began, when the normal direction of up and down reasserted itself. Chapter 6. Waiting a reply. To pursue and keep sight of the annexator was now our chief thought. An enormous interval, trifling though it was in comparison with the depths of space across which Mars lay, separated the two cars, and the annexator was only visible to us as a dim point of light, scarcely distinguishable with the highest telescopic power that we could bring to bear. But for the chance event of her transit between us and the dark phase of the moon, we should never have observed her so far and faintly perceptible a speck on the multitudinously dotted background of the heavens. It would be many days before we could gain upon her near enough to discern more than this little glimmering spark, whose path alone enabled us to say, confidently, that yonder our rival sped along. Meanwhile, the regions of space were not devoid of other excitement for us than that of the long pursuit. Every now and then, other little moving sparks flashed up out of the darkness and passed by in various directions. These were meteor stones shining in the sunlight, and from time to time the earthquake recorder would indicate a slight shock, the tiny counterpart of what we had suffered in passing the moon, showing that one of these small celestial wanderers of unusual dimensions had shot past us at dangerously close quarters. In fact, we were undergoing a continual bombardment, as if the powers of the universe had determined to resist our intrusion into these domains never before invaded by denizens of the Earth. But so long as we did not cross the track of a comet, for along these tracks the meteor swarms lie thickest, we were comparatively safe. The sun, far below our feet, was not as the ordinary Earth-dweller sees it through the veiling air, but as it appears to the astronomer through his instruments, only that it was changed in color, for on Earth we see it through the atmosphere, which has a tinting influence of its own. Far out above, the annexator caught his rays and glinted them back to us with increased brilliancy as the days wore on, until at last the glowing speck was clothed with size and form discernible by the unassisted eye. It was probable, however, that to those on board of her, our car, the Pioneer, was still invisible, or at least indistinguishable from a meteorite, reflecting a thin streak of light from one side, like the crescent gleam of the new moon. On a larger scale than that of our tiny car, this was the aspect which the Earth now presented, and the Moon, through all her changing aspects to the dwellers on the Earth, presented to us continually a thin crescent phase. She would not be at her full for us until several months from the time of our setting out, when she would be so far away, on the remoter side of the sun, as to appear a mere speck, like the annexator when first sighted, if visible at all. But our attention was little given to these matters. It was concentrated upon the moving point of light ahead, or us, that grew steadily to our sight, till at length the distance between the annexator and the pioneer was no more than that across which two ships can easily exchange signals from quarterdeck to quarterdeck. Not a sign was given that we had yet been observed. It was most probable still that we had not. Of the annexator, we could see only so much as was turned to the sun's beams. There being no atmosphere to diffuse the light around, there were no half tones. All the shadows were of absolute blackness, continuous with the absolute blackness of the background of sky. If we ranged alongside, then neither car would be visible to those on board of the other, except that the outer ends of the observation tubes would be seen as dots of light, like the cabin windows of a ship whose hull is lost in midnight darkness out on the ocean. Save these, the eclipsing of a portion of the heavens would alone reveal that some large object was keeping the observer's car company. "Can we not signal to them?" inquired Riva anxiously. "If we had a gun..." "What would you do with it?" asked Apollo, smiling. "Fire, to attract their attention," answered Fred, "but perhaps the walls would keep the sound back too much. Unless, perhaps, we could rig a pistol and put it outside through the waste valve." "It would be all the same," said Apollo. "They would not hear anything. There is no air or anything else in between to carry the sound. We can signal, but it will be for their eyes, not their ears." He touched a button, and instantly the black gaps in the annexator's form were filled with light. It was the illumination from the pioneer's signaling lamps, now lit for the first time. We waited to see if any notice would be taken, but no sign came. Then Apollo began to flash our lamps, extinguishing them and relighting them in rapid succession. It seemed impossible that if anyone was at the annexator's view tubes, this flashing should fail to be noticed, and yet hour after hour passed, the two cars keeping close company, without the trace of any signal corning to us in reply. "This is mighty uncivil," growled Apollo, as at length, fatigued, he ceased from his exertions and turned his eyes back to the inside of the Pioneer. "On the high seas, a ship that refuses to answer is suspected of piracy, so it is in keeping with their character anyhow. I should like to be able to send a round shot across her bows." An idea seemed to strike him, and he reached over to the speed lever. In a few moments we glided faster and passed gradually ahead. He renewed the signaling from there. Still there was no result, and the annexator continued to move in our rear, as she had moved when ahead of us, at the same even pace and with the unswerving direction of an uncontrolled mass. We fell back again to a position alongside and held a consultation. It seemed barely possible, but not at all probable, that during the whole time of our signaling, those on board the other car had all been absent from her observation tubes. What other explanation could be thought of for the way in which our presence was utterly ignored? Were the annexator's crew really playing possum of deliberate purpose? Or perchance had some catastrophe befallen them, and was the car, without human guidance, ploughing its way mechanically towards the star depths, like one of the fever ships that is sometimes met on the ocean, with sails set or funnel smoking, holding on a well-trimmed course, but with not a living soul on board?
I hope you enjoyed chapters 5 and 6 of The World's Last Wonder. In Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast 9, you'll be able to hear chapters 7 and 8, which feature a deep understanding of gravity in space by the characters, something that many science fiction TV shows in the 21st century still struggle with. A nail-biting situation ensues when meeting their antagonists on the way to Mars, and in a moment of goodwill, it is decided that they could lock their space cars together and transfer materials via the waste tubes. The first appearance of an airlock in Australian science fiction. Thank you for listening.
Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast.